ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
What do these careers have in common? An FBI agent, a school social worker, an environmental protection specialist, and even a political lobbyist. Well, you can prepare for all of those careers at UWM's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. On this edition of UWM Today, we continue our year-long celebration of UWM's 60th anniversary with a detailed look at one of the university's 14 schools and colleges. And today, Stan Stojkovic, the dean of the Bader School of Social Welfare, is here to talk about how he and his colleagues are preparing their students for a wide variety of critically important jobs that serve the public. Welcome, Stan. Good to have you back on again.
Thank you for having me.
And I guess we begin by talking about that word service. When you think about School of Social Welfare and service, the two really go together, don't they?
Yeah, they're synonymous almost. In the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, we are committed to service and the idea that we're going to train professionals, whether they be police officers, social workers, lobbyists, individuals who are in the human service work. We're committed to service. And so in our component, in our outreach, what we do is a lot of training. So we're not only educating the future leaders, the future workers in the human service systems across the country, around Wisconsin, around the Midwest, we are also training those people. And so we have a lot of support. So service is a big part of who we are in the school.
When we think about the two categories in the school, criminal justice and social welfare, I can't think of two areas where you might have, frankly, you know, a tougher job when you think about the people who are out on the front line mm-hmm. of providing that service. Police officers, law enforcement officers, and then folks who are helping families often go through some very, very difficult and trying times. Do you have to have psychology courses to help bolster the stamina of your students?
Actually, we don't. I mean, we have always had a very robust enrollment. I used to facetiously say many years ago when I was teaching in the criminal justice side of the house that if I were to jump on the top of Enderis Hall, the building where we're located on campus, and tell people, don't come here, they would still come in droves. So we must have a good product. There's something that we do, faculty, staff, students, that synergy, that interaction, that ultimately says to people, I want to be part of this. And they learn about it. You know, word of mouth is the best and free advertising that you can get. People know that our placement in the community, our placement nationally, even in some cases internationally, is really, really important to our students. And our students come in, and we have huge numbers of students. So getting people to come and to really entertain these professions is really not that difficult. Many people have it in their heart. We want to guide their head. And we want those to come together ultimately to produce a consummate professional, an individual that can be hired and can do human service work. God knows we have a host of those kinds of issues that society has to deal with. So we're committed to this long-term vision of service and to training our people. So it really isn't difficult to get them to come on board.
Is there a lot of crossover when you think about the courses that a future law enforcement officer takes versus what a social worker might be studying?
Well, you know, that's interesting you say that because that has been, I wouldn't say a debate, but a concern raised over many decades. Former police chief Phil Areola used to say that in Milwaukee here, he used to say that, you know, if a cop knew what police work was really about before he or she began, they'd be a social worker. And if a social worker really knew what social work was about, they'd be a cop. And I always thought that was an interesting play of words. And, you know, he understood the idea that most of law enforcement is social service work, is human service work. 90% of what they do is service calls. People are in distress. There's trouble. You know, there may be violence. There may be criminal activity. Obviously, they enforce the law. But they do much more than that. So there is a natural blend between understanding the human condition in society, the problems that emanate, the role of law enforcement, the role of the criminal justice system on the one hand, but on the other hand, the important idea of social service and connection and how do we solve these problems? How do we bring these together? In fact, the genesis of criminal justice really at UWM in the early 1970s was the idea of using ideas, thoughts, theories, evidence generated in social work and trying to bring those two together. And we have, I think, done a very good job of doing that.
Let's talk about law enforcement. Over the last year, there have been a lot of stories about how well-trained officers are. Do they have the preparation to allow them to work effectively in diverse communities? The whole Black Lives Matter movement triggered by what mm-hmm. some people believe was poorly trained officers, officers who weren't following the code. Do those issues come up in the curriculum, in the classroom, as you think about today's students getting ready to?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've got such a variety of courses. What makes our courses on the criminal justice side of the house so appealing to students is not only do we have well-trained, educationally trained, academically trained, PhD people doing cutting research and instruction and bringing that in the classroom, we have a whole cadre of part-time people who work in the criminal justice system. So my philosophy as dean has always been, we have to have a nice blend of practice and theory. And those two coming together produce a professional. And that's really what we need. And so a host of our courses are taught by district attorneys, public defenders, judges in some cases, police chiefs. We run the whole spectrum of the criminal justice system that we try to integrate, usually reserved for our upper division courses. We lay the foundation, theoretically, with our academic people, our research. We get students involved in research. Students today are much more interested in answering these tough questions. Why does racism exist? How are the police at the forefront? How can the criminal justice system change itself in such a way to be cognizant of these kinds of problems and offer prescriptions that actually make a lot of sense? Well, that has to be rooted in evidence. And so we have a good relationship, a good thing. I always tell students now, you know, I've been at UWM for 33 years. I've been dean the last 13 years. Students are on the upward slope. Stan is on the downward slope, okay? He's on the other side. They're going to carry the day. So we have to make sure that we prepare people for these future considerations. So those types of topics are very much discussed because they have to be discussed. You can't think of society today. You can't think of crime management, without thinking about those issues.
I remember once you told me that if you looked around the state of Wisconsin at the villages, the towns, the cities, a lot of those police departments have police chiefs who have spent some time in the Bader School of Social Welfare.
Absolutely. In fact, at one time, it's not true anymore, 19 municipalities in the county of Milwaukee that have law enforcement entities, every one of them had some affiliation, either an undergraduate degree or a master's degree from our program. Now, again, that's not true necessarily right now. I would suspect that maybe 20% to a third have that, but that's a guess on my part. But do we have an influence in criminal justice across this region, across the state, and even internationally? Yes, we do. We have people all over the world, quite frankly. And I hear from them. And their stories are fantastic stories, how they started. Oh, I remember you. You were my professor, for example, you know, back in 1985. And now I'm running a terrorism unit for the FBI in Sweden. I mean, that's one example, you know, where individuals really are out there. They're in the system. We've got people all over the place. And they contact me, you know, just rather fortuitously, or they get a lark and they send me an email and they say, oh, do you remember me? Sadly, more often than not, I don't remember. As I tell students today, I've probably had 20,000 students in my career at UWM. And so it's a lot of faces to remember. But some of them, especially the ones that really are shining stars, they really stick out. And we're really, really proud of them.
I want to talk a little bit about the research that you mentioned takes place within the school. And I'm going to actually begin with your story, because I was always fascinated to hear about the work that you've done with jails and prisons. Mm-hmm. What got you interested in looking at life behind the bars?
Well, that is sort of an interesting story. It goes back to my father. My father was an immigrant from the former Yugoslavia. Post-World War II.
Thus the name Stojković, which is the easiest name not to spell on campus.
I always have it on my card phonetically for those who need assistance. If my name was Smith, I wouldn't need that. But yeah, my father was in a camp after the war, and he was in some dire circumstances, but he never would talk about it. He, you know, we knew that he was there, and he was there for a number of years after the war. He was a displaced person. But, that impressed upon me, what kind of things do people do to survive, even as a young man, in that kind of system? So I started, preparing myself for those types of things. And then ultimately, when I went to graduate school at Michigan State, I worked in a prison, at that time the largest walled prison in the world. the State Prison of Southern Michigan. I started as a teacher, and I wound up working in administrative segregation units, trying to manage people who were very mentally ill in many cases, violent, disciplinary problems, that type of stuff. But that stretched out in my writing, my research, all the way to leading a executive leadership institute currently for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. I did it for them for about 10 years, from 94 to 04. They asked me last year to come back and start it up again. So we had about 13-year hiatus, and I said yes, and so I was just recently out there. So that's the largest corrections department in the world. It's got 60,000 employees, and we're having a mark. My chair of criminal justice, Tina Freiberger, is also part of that effort and that initiative. So we're very happy about that. We're very proud that we're connected to the field. We're eggheads, I'll admit it. We love research. We love writing. We write for audiences that love those things. And sometimes that doesn't get translated. But I believe we have to translate it. And so our research has to really comport and really move into what's happening in the community.
So as you study jails, as you look at life in prison, how has it changed in the years that you've been either working in prisons before you became a full-time academic to today, where you are a consultant helping provide ideas on best practices? Are prisons any different today than they were 20 years ago?
Well, they're similar on some in some respects, and they're dissimilar. The biggest dissimilarity is the size. Size and scale. I mean, the number of people who have gone to prison in the last 40 years has been just astronomical, and really has worked to serve to the detriment of people who run institutions. I tell particularly frontline people who oftentimes get a confusion about their role vis-a-vis a prisoner, may not have anything in common with that prisoner. Many of these prisons are in rural areas, rural background, limited exposure to people of different cultures, different races. And there's a natural clash that occurs sometimes unless people are appropriately and properly trained and supervised. And so I always have seen that over the last 30, 40 years, massive growth, what we call mass incarceration, just more people going to prison. It finally came to a head probably about 6-7 years ago when states just finally said, enough's enough. We don't have the money. Conservative foundations actually came out against mass incarceration, arguing that, you know, we just don't have the dollars to do this. And if we do have the dollars, we should spend them more wisely. And so we start to see some major changes in that regard. But prison is prison at one level, but the prison of today is potentially more dangerous, difficult to manage, largely because of numbers, limited budgets. Take, for example, Wisconsin. I mean, the Wisconsin Department of Corrections gets more state budget than the University of Wisconsin system. That's just a fiscal reality. And, you know, it costs money to run these institutions. And you have to ask questions of what's efficacy? What are we getting our bang for our buck? And in some cases, we are. And in a lot of cases, we're not. And so I try to help people to think about those types of things. And hopefully, we've had an impact. And I think we have in a very positive way.
As you think about the training that goes into preparing a prison guard, someone who is in that intimate, face-to-face, daily, personal encounter with people. Is it possible to take the example that you used of someone who has a completely, totally different cultural background, personal background from the prisoners that they're serving? Can you teach them to relate better, or is the answer finding folks who have a similar life background or life backstory, and to come in and work with prisoners?
It's probably a little of both. I mean, the fact of the matter, first of all, prison guard is an anachronism. They're correctional officers, and they'll tell you they're correctional officers. So a lot of the characterization of prison guard goes back to a negative characterization: brutal, sadistic, you know, rough, ignorant.
Cool Hand Luke is coming to mind.
Yeah, it's the old time of movies, you know, and those are old time movies. That's all they are at this point in time. Correctional officers and the language of corrections has changed so significantly. The California Department of Corrections for about 100 years was the California Department of Corrections. Now it's the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, which changed about 10 years ago. And name matters. What you call people does ultimately matter. So we can train people, and we can train people how this is a professional job, and there's a professional way and professional decorum and professional standards. And we have the American Correctional Association, for example, that provides those standards. So training is one thing, but that's where a lot of people fall down. The training is usually pretty good, okay? Where we fall down is the supervision, and that's at a different level. So those people who are supervising correctional officers, for example, the same argument is made in police circles too. It's not so much getting the right person, psychological screening, good testing, good training, that type of thing. Yeah, that's important. But at the end of the day, supervision is more important. How are we actually watching people in the performance of their duties? If they're stepping out of bounds, how are we pulling them back in? Are we retraining them? Are we providing an adequate progressive disciplinary system? There's, you know, complex organizational kinds of issues and dollar issues start to arise. But that's where we fall down in I think, the criminal justice system is we train a lot at the entry level. We have good training at the executive level. But in the middle, we tend to fall down. And that's a huge, huge issue that I think needs to be rectified. I've spent a lot of time on that over the last 10, 15 years.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Stan Stojkovic. Stan is dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. This is part of our 60th anniversary series, where each month we're taking a look at each of the 14 schools and colleges that now are part of one of the biggest educational institutions in the state, number two in terms of number of students, and also a Research One University, one of the top 115 research universities out of the more than 4,600 colleges and universities across the country. So let's talk a little bit about the social welfare side. You talked about how closely they're linked. Your background is really leaning on the criminal justice side, mm-hmm. but you said before that if you aren't aware of what is being discussed in those social welfare classes, you really can't be a good law enforcement officer or a good corrections officer.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a bridge, and we have our own difficulties in trying to make sure those bridges occur between social work department and criminal justice department. We're a small school on campus. We have a large enrollment, but the social work program is really, really committed to producing professionals who are ultimately going to be at the front line. Many of our students coming to us who are very young, you know, they want to get clinical skills. They want to understand, you know, social work practice. They want to understand, how do I work with people in a clinical setting? How do I work with them in school setting, a hospital setting, hospice, caregiving? I mean, it cuts the whole spectrum. I like to say that there isn't a person in this country, before he or she dies, doesn't have some kind of interaction with a social worker, either for a family member or for themselves. So social work becomes this very pivotal area where we have to support people and train them appropriately. And I think that what we do in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare is that social work has a strong, strong history in this community, in this state. We're not only large, we get a large number of people. You know, a lot of people don't know, but the largest master's program on campus is the master's program in social work. It has huge enrollments. We have huge applications every year. Unfortunately, we have to turn some people back because we don't have the resources and the opportunity to train everyone. But there is a demand. There is a need. There's always going to be a demand for people who will focus on issues like family well-being, child well-being, poverty, racism. These issues tend to permeate our culture, unfortunately, and how do we address those? How do we prepare professionals who have to understand that people come from obviously different cultural backgrounds, different races, different languages? This is truly a melting pot that can turn into a boiling cauldron. We have a history of that in America. So we're frontline people. You know, when people say, you know, well, you want to be a social worker, you know, almost in a pejorative sense, they either don't have any sense of what social work is about, because these people are not wimps. You know, these are people who are going out and tackling some of the toughest problems that you can imagine in our community. And they're told to do it under real austere circumstances. I like to say the phrase that social work, like criminal justice, has infinite expectations placed on it, but only finite resources.
And you see people who are often at the worst point in their life.
Absolutely.
Either physically or emotionally, mentally. They're in a crisis stage, and the social worker has to step in and try to either put the pieces back together or at least put some tape on it to hold folks together to move forward.
Social work can be understood, I think, conceptually and in practice along two dimensions. One, there was what we call macro policy. Macro social work is really policy. What about policy that you know, really makes poverty worse or makes it better? So there are macro issues, poverty, education, health care, all these kinds of things we can look at in a macro sense, a large sense. But then there's more at the operational level. Most of our students come in, they're interested in being that person that can help someone. You know, and you have to give them a lot of credit, because they feel, listen, yeah, everybody wants to pay bills. Everybody's got to pay their mortgage. We understand that. But we also want individuals who are committed to I make a difference, and this works for me. And I say, our role is to stoke your passion. You come to us with a passion. We want to stoke that passion, but we also want to make you competent. And if you're passionate about your work and you're competent about your work, you'll never work a day in your life. I tell our students that all the time. I said, that's what you want. That's the kind of career you want. And I think we do a very good job with our connections, again, with part-time people who are working in the field. They're our instructors as well as our full-time faculty. Faculty's role is primarily that research one. That full-time faculty are committed. We get the best possible people. I'm going back after this interview and trying to recruit a couple more people to the school who have outstanding backgrounds and can contribute to our knowledge base. But that's what we're about. Our mission is to strengthen community and individuals, through education, research, and service. That's our mission.
How do you keep folks who are on that front line, whether they're a law enforcement officer or a social worker dealing with people in crisis situations, how do you prepare them so that they themselves don't burn out when trying to help others?
Well, unfortunately, burnout is and turnover is a huge issue in social service organizations. And it's not so much the people, and it's not so much the people that they're dealing with, those that are in crisis, for example. It's how we organize those entities and deliver the services. I used to say to people, I could figure out the prisoners in about 2 weeks when I first started working in prison. It took me years to figure out the administrators. And that's a management issue. That's where I spend a lot of my time in terms of administration, management, and focus. The problems we can address, we have the technical skill to address those things. The real issue is, do we have the political will to address the issues, and do we have the appropriate resources to organize something that can realistically address the issues? That's where everything falls down, because public service work, whether it's teaching, nursing, police work, it doesn't matter, is typically grossly underfunded. And in our tax revolution days that we are now, a lot of people aren't interested in paying for stuff like that. And so you have to be very efficient in how you do what you do.
As you think about the role that these graduates play when they walk out as alum of UWM with a social welfare, criminal justice degrees, many of them are going to be working for the city, for Milwaukee County, mm-hmm. for the state, or as you pointed out before, agencies all around the world. What kind of relationships does the school have with those other entities? Are there intern programs? Is there mentoring opportunities?
One of the big advantages that we have is, by nature of our profession, we have to be out in the community. So we have literally hundreds of agencies that we have students placed at. Yesterday, we honored some of our criminal justice entities at a basketball game during one of the commercial timeouts. And these entities take our students, they train our students, they offer them opportunity. And I can't tell you how many students wind up getting then employed by that agency. So we are connected to the field. We're not just simply theoretical. Theory is what we're about. We're an academic institution. Building knowledge is what we're about. But we're also, in this area of human service, we have to be connected to the field. So our research has to be translated. Our students have to be trained in the field, among the police, among the social workers, among the individuals in those human service agencies, nonprofit agencies, governmental agencies. We've got placements all over the world. All right. Most of our students are going to stay in southeastern Wisconsin. Similar to what the UWM typical student, about 80% will stay in southeastern Wisconsin. And they have plenty of problems to address and plenty of agencies. And this has been a very valuable experience, I think, for a lot of students. Now, they branch out into all sorts of disciplines. We have very successful business people who started as social workers. We have people who are very successful attorneys, both criminal attorneys as well as private attorneys. I mean, they're all over the place. And I like that, because that puts out the name of the school and really commemorates Helen Bader, the person for whom the school is named after, really, really well.
Does the progression always work that way, where somebody starts out young as a social worker and then see their careers morph or transform into something else? Or do people come to you who have had careers in areas that mm-hmm. might not really be connected to social welfare, but at some point in their life they say, I want to give back. I want to do something different.
Yeah, we have both. We have scholarships, for example, that are set up for people who are above the age of 40. We're coming back in the social work side of the house. We have graduates who were in that position, and now their families have endowed scholarships that allow us to give money to people who are just like them, who are, you know, second career or maybe third career, or they raised a family and now they want to go back. I mean, the story of Helen Bader, for example, is very analogous to that, coming back to school and in this case to the school of social work, social welfare at the time, and back in the 70s, and really interested in the elderly and interested in the poor and legal representation. And so there's a strong history there, and we support it through our efforts.
And so how did the school get Helen Bader's name? What was the background?
The impetus there was Helen Bader was, you know, married to Alfred Bader, and they had a very successful chemical company, Aldrich Chemical in Milwaukee, one of the most successful chemical companies in the world. And she came back to school in the mid-70s and wanted and understood the plight of the poor, especially people who didn't have legal representation, individuals who were older. She was thinking about gerontology, what we call gerontology today, when people nobody was thinking about it. She was thinking about dementia and Alzheimer's, maybe not specifically, but she was thinking, how are we going to care for people who have these types of ailments? And I want to get involved in that, and I want to put my money behind that. Tragically, she died very young. She died in the late 80s. In the early 90s, her sons took on the mantle, David and Dan Bader, and created the Helen Bader Foundation, named after her, with the idea that they would sunset after about 30 years. But recently, in the last few years, they came together with Alfred Bader, the father, and they have now Bader Philanthropies, and they still support the school, and we have a major endowment. And we changed the name out of honor to Helen Bader, and I think Dan Bader in particular was very, very proud of his mother's works and wanted to make sure her legacy continued. And that's what the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare is all about. She represents our typical student, and that's really important because she came from a background where, listen, we really need to help people. And I think a lot of people understood that. And she understood it. She was more, I think, privileged than compared to many of our students now. But she understood the importance of addressing the concerns that we have.
What do you think she would say about the school today if she came back?
Oh, I think she'd shake my hand. You know, I think she'd say, good job, keep on going. Because she understood, I believe, what I understand as well, is that this is a continual fight. This is not, you know, there's always a battle. There's always a concern. We see now a lot of changes in legislation, changes in elected officials, changes in our president. Those are going to have tremendous ramifications on social work and criminal justice. But we're going to be there. We're not going to go anywhere. We're going to stand and fight the fight because we think we do a very good job at it.
Always a need.
Yep. Yep. Always going forward.
Well, Stan, thanks so much for coming in and talking about how you and other members of the Bader School meet that need, and continued best wishes as you move forward for the next 60 years.
Thank you very much, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Stan Stojkovic, Dean of UWM's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, our guest on this 60th anniversary edition of UWM Today as we celebrate UWM's service here in the community. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujak.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujak, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.